It's Will Sean Podcast. The internet cried out for two more blowhards, and they courageously answered that call. Armed with the weapon of wit, each week they're joined by guests to discuss movies, television, pop culture, and anything else that's pissing them off. Take it away, boys.
I'm Will Link.
And I'm Sean David.
And this is Will Sean Podcast.
All 15 episodes in one crazed, sleepless weekend. How you doing, Will?
So I did another essay performance last week at Tattletales.
Run by Michael Patrick Duggan.
Yes, who former guest was nice enough to have me down here. And this essay was about the time I visited an S&M club.
The first time.
And met my friend Nikki the Switch. And the problem is, I've read this essay twice now. I've performed it twice. And the problem is, whenever I read this essay, afterwards, everybody kind of comes up to me on the side. You got to take me to this place. You got to take... Everybody wants to go to an S&M club.
We're all closet freaks.
I love it. And now, like Moses of the S&M club, I have to lead my people to the bondage, I guess.
You have to lead them into the house of bondage.
Yes.
You're the anti-Moses.
Hey.
I think you should charge money and get a tour and say, yeah, it's sex tourism.
And I'll cut Nikki a little bit on
she
the
gets
side.
A little bit. She puts on a show for them. She gets the cattle prod, a couple toys, and they get the full experience. I think it's a brilliant idea.
This is not a bad idea. This is how we'll fund
improvements.
Yeah, up to the podcast. This is how we'll get new mics. What's going on in the world of Will Sean Podcast?
We've had a couple additional likes, and want to thank our guest last week, Liz Femi, and just remind you that you can still get tickets to her show, Take Me to the Poorhouse, and use the promo code WillSean for 10% off.
Yeah.
So everything is going great. Once again, it's summertime, nothing better to do. Tell your friends, like us on Facebook, Twitter. All the usual outlets.
Sit at the beach and listen to a podcast.
That's right, because you know what? Reading is dead, people. No one reads anymore.
Exactly. Instead, you plug in your iPod and you watch the ocean.
And listen to us bitch about inanities.
Who's our sponsor this week?
Well, Will, have you or a loved one been exposed to asbestos or diagnosed with mesothelioma? Perhaps you're looking for medical or legal advice. Should you hire an attorney, get representation, or do you even qualify for compensation and how to file? Mesothelioma is a disease that can only be acquired through exposure to asbestos. Even families of exposure victims are at risk from secondary exposure. Blah, 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 blah. I better not end up on this fucking trial.
So is that brought to you by mesothelioma or the jury system of Los Angeles?
County of Los Angeles judicial system.
Ah, it's good to see them back sponsoring us.
Yeah.
On the show this week, Sean has already alluded to it. Arrested Development came back. How was it? We're going to tell you. Will Smith bought his kid a movie franchise. We're going to talk about that. And this week is an enemy we all had to deal with a couple of weeks ago because of Mother's Day. And it's a scourge that I'm going to put a stop to.
Well, not everyone has mothers.
Well, those of us are lucky enough to. But first, we're very excited. Our guest today, he is producing, raising funds for a documentary called Doomed, The Untold Story of Roger Corman's Fantastic Four, Mark Sykes.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome. Thank you.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very happy to be here.
Where do we start?
Well, let's start at the beginning. I'm really fascinated by the idea for this documentary. But before we get into it, I want to talk a little bit about you. How did you get started in the business? You do casting, right?
I'm a casting director. I've been a casting director since working for Roger Corman. I started with him in 1992. I was one of those stories where I was an intern, unpaid.
Yeah.
I moved out here from Massachusetts in 1992. And wouldn't leave until they hired me and gave me a job. And I was the receptionist at first.
Okay.
And again, I wouldn't leave until they gave me a better job. And I was the receptionist during Fantastic Four. I got a casting assistant credit only because I got people to cover the phones while I went in on the casting sessions.
Interesting.
Nice. So, because you always hear stories about people getting their start with Corman. I mean, for people who don't know, he is the
super producer of B-movies, I guess.
King of the Bees.
King of the Bees.
And done more than anybody.
He gave breaks to such young talents as Ron Howard, Jonathan Demme, Martin Scorsese, James Cameron. Even more than that.
And there were a lot of people who maybe did their first film with him,
right,
who broke out on television. Sandra Bullock had just done a movie with him when I got there.
Interesting.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, he would make tons of movies. He'd make them quick. He'd make them cheap. And I think he also still holds the record for the fastest produced studio theatrical release, which is it's the Edgar Allan Poe, which is the Mask of the Red Death.
Yeah.
It's 9 days he made that film.
Whoa.
But, you know, Fassbender, teach him a thing or two.
Now, what I find most interesting that you said is, like, you just hung around. Like, they didn't make you leave? Is that the way? Like, how does it work there, Corman?
Well, if you're willing to... I wanted nothing more than to... I came here to work in the film industry.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any family or friends. So I really... I don't want to say I was desperate, but I didn't have a lot of avenues in, and I didn't know about becoming a PA at a studio system or TV. So I very simply, I saw an ad in the Daily Bruin and called the office and said, I want to intern. And they said, come on over to a meeting. And of course, at the meeting, they make it seem like there's a selection process.
Yeah.
You have to fill out paperwork. And then, you know, a week later, you show up and everybody at that meeting is there. And it's... The selection process is very open.
Undergo a battery of psychological tests.
Yeah, and the beauty is everybody goes there thinking Roger is going to pass you in the men's room, see something in you, and hand you a film to direct or write or produce. And, of course, that's never going to happen. So a lot of people who come there leave. You know, interns were dropping like flies. It was great. And I wouldn't. And I didn't have to. I got a night job. I was working a 40-hour-a-week job at a video arcade in Westwood, just, you know, on weekends and nights, 40 hours a week. So my time during the week from 9 to 5 was wide open. So I went in there and I said, I'm going
to
give you 40 hours a week. Which
that's the way to do
nobody
it.
Else could do.
Right.
And I just all of a sudden went to work and made myself as indisposable as possible. I learned the phone system. I was his projectionist on these antique film projectors.
Yeah.
I did everything, and I did it for free, and I finally earned a job.
Well, that's the way you got to do it with the Corman's company. You did it right.
Now, since the early 90s, how many films do you think you've been associated with that have gone through there?
Corman's?
Yeah.
Oh, about 30.
Okay.
Because I did go back. I left to work at another big, you know, production company.
Got it.
But then when I was in between gigs, I got to go back and do a couple freelance gigs there. Dino Croc.
Okay. What about Sharktopus?
No. That was after my time. I wasn't
that was
lucky.
More recent.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. But Dino Croc and Shakedown were the two I went back to do.
Okay.
And you're still doing, not necessarily that, but you're doing casting work now. And how do you like that?
I love it. I've been doing it for 20 years. And the beautiful thing about Roger's company was that I got to work in every department. You know,
so
as
you
an
learned
intern.
A little bit of everything.
I got to get mentored by these vice presidents.
It was almost like the old old studio system where everyone was a hands-on craftsman.
Absolutely. No, I gave notes. I gave notes on Fantastic Four, and you know, they didn't know me. I mean, I went to film school, but that wasn't why they let me give notes. They'll get notes. They'll give the interns notes. You know, and say, hey, read the script or sit in on the screening and give us your opinion. They're very open like that.
As doing casting, because we've never actually had any, before we get into it, because we haven't had anybody really from casting ever on the show. Like, how many people do you have to, like, I mean, you see every act. I mean, how many actors I can only imagine you see of?
I just released a film in the breakdowns about 10 days ago, and for a laugh, I added up the submissions, and they change every day, but they were roughly... For 10 parts, we had, I think, 14,000 submissions.
Whoa.
But those are just submissions. How many
of those? Just submissions, yes. Many of those people were just, like, wrong. They should never have been submitted.
They're just blindly submitting to anything they can.
Yeah, it was interesting. How many people will we see? Much smaller amount, depending on the film. It depends on how much time they have, usually, because I don't typically charge a producer by the day.
Right.
As much as, like, I want to get this right. So if we have to do 20 sessions and we have to see 1,000 people, 2,000 people, we see how many we have to see. Typically, I get called up and they want this thing done in 2 weeks. and I've got five sessions to cast 10 parts, and you're maybe seeing 50 people for a part.
Are there also, like, people that obviously you've probably worked with before that
absolutely.
Sometimes when you get the, like, oh, this is perfect.
Yeah,
for...
he wasn't good for that role, but...
Absolutely. Yeah. Casting is a real cumulative thing. I cast a gal in a lead about a year and a half ago, a film called Tentacle 8, and I gave her her first film job in 1997 when I was working at PM Entertainment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that many years later, and there you are again. And it was to some degree because of that.
I'm loving the names of the movies we're discussing this with. Tentacle 8.
It gets better. Yeah. Well, and ironically, Tentacle 8 is not a giant squid movie. It's an espionage movie.
Really?
That refers to the arms of a secret government cabal.
Aren't all secret cabals from the government?
Yes.
Now, was there anyone that ever came in for an audition that we may know, and I'm just throwing this out there, that when they came in, they just blew you away and you knew immediately, like, this is something special?
Jennifer Garner.
Really?
Oh.
I read Jennifer Garner several times in the 90s and desperately tried to cast her because she was the total package. She was so sweet and so talented, and you just wanted to be on... You fell in love with her, but also you just... There was a lot of talent there and training, and you just wanted to... When you've been in casting a while, you do start to collect. So you're looking for the people who are going to be the stars of tomorrow. It certainly improves
and
your cachet.
And you've seen so many people that immediately you know what different looks like or what special looks like.
Absolutely. Well, and you're also... Part of special is personality.
Well, I was going to say, you don't want to just cast some asshole.
You don't want to.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, now let's talk about this. Now, this fantastic... Now, I've never seen this film. I know it's a film that sometimes, like, there are underground copies of or stuff, right?
Did someone mention about the
YouTube? It's one of the most bootlegged films in history because, unlike all the big tentpole films that get bootlegged and then ultimately released, this never got released. So for 20 years, all you can do is buy a bootleg.
Well, it's this and Leni Riefenstahl's 12-hour cut of Triumph of the Will, right?
Yeah, those are the two
those
big
ones that get passed around for years.
And I don't think you can get that at Comic-Con.
No, different...
different
Nazi
kind of con, yeah. But so this fantastic four film. So, I mean, obviously this documentary you're making is about how this came to be, so...
And why it didn't.
And why it didn't. So, I mean, I guess tell us... As much as I guess you're willing to give away for your documentary as to why it didn't, I guess.
Well, we're going to discover some of those details ourselves because we're going to be interviewing cast and crew this summer. And we don't know all the details. I mean, I was there, but there are still some... I've been talking to the cast just a little bit because I want to preserve the spontaneity of the interviews. But I'm desperately... loving information because we've already heard some things that I didn't know.
Now, this movie was shot in the early 90s, you mentioned.
How it came about was that Bernd Eichinger from New Constantine Films came to Roger in 1992, probably around September, and said, my 10-year option on this film is about to run out, and if I don't go into production on The Fantastic Four by December 31st, I lose it and I lose all my money. He'd been trying, obviously, to get it made at a big studio for years. Couldn't do it. Roger was his last hope because Roger's one of the guys who could go into production within 30 or 40 days.
Right.
So he goes to Roger. They make a deal. They make the film. We shot it. They didn't want to go right to the 31st, Roger had said. They started shooting December 28th, 1992, and then they went into January, and they were done by the end of January. And through post and everything else, 6 months or so, we went around and put it out. I went down to the comic show here at the Shrine, and we introduced the cast. And then word came down sometime, I think, in the summer, and they said, we're not releasing it. And that was the first some of us had heard of this possibility.
Right.
There's rumors that others might have heard rumors sooner, and we're going to get to the bottom of that. But... we didn't know, and we'd all been working really hard on this film, and because it was Fantastic Four, and we knew the extenuating circumstances of Roger getting his hands on it, we actually thought this could see a small theatrical release.
Well, plus, you have a built-in audience. It's the Fantastic Four.
But you have to remember, this was during like the fallow period for comic books and comic book movies. No one, it's easy for us now from where we are with all these huge tentpole films and this renaissance.
Any superhero movie that comes out now, it's like it's guaranteed.
It's $1 billion. But there was a long period of time. Was this around the time when the Punisher film?
Yep.
Yeah, that was another Marvel property, wasn't it? Yeah, Punisher. Where they were just dumping these, crappy versions of these properties. I mean, Marvel was not what it is today. You know, it had a slow resurgence. So yeah, I don't necessarily know that there was a built-in fan base for the Fantastic Four, in the mid-90s.
Well, other than
like a small core group.
There was the comic book fan base and just people knowing the entity. I mean, again, we're talking Roger Corman. It's not like a studio where they have, Casper or something else in development. This was a big deal for us.
Right.
And this is also, it's funny because it's also pre-internet buzz.
Right.
Right.
Which has got to be a big factor into now how
pre-internet, not even internet buzz, just
internet. The internet was like just something Al Gore had in his basement.
It's true, just his tubes, tube farm.
The idea of a film that doesn't get released, I think, is so fascinating for a documentary because unlike if someone who writes music or a book that doesn't get released, a film, so many people, even the lowest of budgeted films, so many people have to put so much time and energy into it.
Absolutely. Even on this budget, I think there was over 400 people in the end credits.
Oh, wow.
And this is a Corman film, so it's small compared to a studio, that's a lot.
Was it finished post-production, done, or did they just...
It was done.
Okay.
It was done. I screened, because I was the projectionist, and I screened it through a bunch of different renditions, various phases and edits, and because we were taking it around. The edit was long done,
Okay, so this film has then had a secondary life in the bootleg market.
Absolutely. First at the conventions, and now it is up on YouTube.
What gave you the idea that I want to make a documentary about how, other than what we just said, the fact that have you been to festivals and cons and stuff and hear people talk about this? Like, have you heard buzz about this that made you think we should explore this more?
I'm a comic book geek. From way back. My dad, when I was 7, opened up a comic book store.
Oh, okay.
I grew up in the comic book world. Oh, it was heaven. I grew up in the comic book retail world. I used to go to the San Diego Comic-Con of the 70s, the New York 4th of July Comic-Con.
When it was about comics and not necessarily big tentpole films.
Really? Well, it was about comics and it was about... literally the biggest names in the business would sketch.
Now it's about meeting the cast of CW's Heart of Dixie.
Yeah, it's weird some of the people they have come to these things now.
And all the dealers were collectors.
Right.
They were the customers, too. It was great. And Marty Langford, my producing partner, called me up and said, you worked on this film. It's at every convention out there as a bootleg. This is a great story, which I agreed with. It's got to be told. We should do something. He was thinking about first a book.
Yeah.
And I we talked about it and we went back and forth and we are going to do an ebook. But I was, we quickly agreed, let's do a documentary. He's a film studies teacher back in Massachusetts now, professor. And I'm a film graduate, so.
So now, you got to raise the funds to make this documentary.
Yes.
You're on Indiegogo. Tell us a little bit about.
I wish I was Zach Braff. Right now, I really do.
I was going to ask you about that because that's the big thing now. Zach Braff's getting all this money. I say Zach Braff can get money anywhere. I say give the money to you.
Well, of course, I agree with you. But I'm not one of those vehement Veronica Mars bashers.
Yeah.
I don't care. If the fans want something and the fans will put the money forward for it, wonderful. That's what they do. I would love it, though, if the fans, while they're supporting whatever, looked at our project and said, these guys won't make this movie if they don't get their financing. This isn't, we're not going to be able to fund this ourselves, ever.
Well, I'm not necessarily a basher of the Veronica Mars or Zach Braff stuff, but there is something that, and we talked about this on the show before, there's something, like, I feel like these sites, like Indiegogo and stuff, were designed more for people like you, and there's something I feel odd about.
Not to pre-sell $10 million films to the fans?
Yeah.
Well, it's like you're commercializing Sundance or something. You know, you're taking something that maybe in its inception was meant to be grassroots and let's celebrate film, and now
like Comic-Con.
Yeah, well, exactly. But it seems to be that no matter what we get, we can't have it and keep it grassroots and green and really independent. It's like independent films themselves. They've become basically studio films.
Now, how much are you looking to raise on the Indiegogo?
Our target is $52,000.
Okay, that's a very specific number.
Well, we have a pretty specific budget, and we wanted to make it very clear that we've done the due diligence.
That you know exactly what to the penny of what you need to make this thing the way you want to make it.
I've sat down with different people in post production and sound, and we know rental fees for places and what we're going to do, and we have the cast on board completely. They're so supportive.
Oh, it's got to be
now,
great.
Is there anyone that was in the film that we would know or be familiar with?
Well, they're all working in various forms here. I mean, Joseph Culp, who played Dr. Doom, has recurred on Mad Men as Don Draper's father.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And Rebecca Staub is on television all the
time.
So
these people went on to be just solid working actors. They got careers.
They're total journeyman actors and performers. And Alex Hyde-White just made a documentary. He plays Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic, in the Fantastic Four. And I just actually saw his documentary about mounting a theatrical performance of Hamlet, but there's also a lot about his dad, Sir Alfred Hyde White, and growing up with the famous father.
Is he related to David Hyde Pierce?
He's not. No.
Now what?
I don't think.
Now with this, besides if you contribute this, you get to see a great documentary, but you also get other benefits, right? There are other things on the.
Yeah, when we set out, we get the whole crowdfunding idea, the Indiegogo approach. We understand that you can't just ask for money. I studied the projects like the Veronica Mars and looked at their perk and incentive programs, and very impressive. They did some nice stuff there. And we decided we've got a range anywhere from $10 to $5,000, depending on someone's level.
Every bit helps.
Absolutely. No, we're very encouraging of $10 donations. We give them a shout out on the Facebook page, and we're not going to miss anybody. We really appreciate that, and we want them to feel a part of it too. And then we go up incrementally. And what we've done, which is part of the fun of this campaign, is each incentive level is a Fantastic Four villain.
Okay.
And they go up. The more you donate, for instance, the $10 level is a Doombot.
Okay.
Not exactly. I think one of us could probably dispatch a Doombot, given some time. And we go up through, the Red Ghost and the Puppet Master until we get up to...
Now is the ultimate villain...
Dr. Doom is pretty high, and then the ultimate nullifier is the very top tier, because it is the weapon that the Fantastic Four used to defeat Galactus, and it ends all existence. So it's even Trump Dr. Doom.
So Tim Story is not the ultimate villain.
Oddly enough, he's not.
Now, so where can everybody go to see this Indiegogo page so they could see all this information, figure out, where do we go? Where do we find this all?
The Indiegogo page, indiegogo.com, you can search Doom, because our page is a lot of, it's the full name, Doom.
Oh, so just Doomed.
The Untold Story of Roger Corman's The Fantastic Four is the official name, but there's a lot of hyphens and dashes in there. So what I'm telling everyone is it's indiegogo.com, search Doomed.
And you'll find it,
yeah. And they can find,
it's fast. Yeah.
I know you have the Facebook page for this, you have a Twitter for this.
Yeah.
So if you find those as well, if you search Doomed for those, you'll also find the links to the Indiegogo page. And quite frankly, If you're a good listener of the podcast, you've already been to our Facebook page, and you see that we have a link for this on there, so you can just go to our page, click on the link to the Indiegogo, and you know what? Times are tight, I get it, but you got 10 bucks that you can throw in to see a documentary on the Fantastic Four, especially some of my old friends on Long Island who would love this. Sean Corkery, I'm talking to you. Toss this guy 20, 30 bucks. Toss him something. Do it.
Today was our one-week anniversary. It's a one-month campaign, and we added a couple incentive levels on the lower end of things, a $25 and a $35 level. So there's some great perks, including autographed pictures from the cast. Very affordable.
Oh, that's great.
Very cool.
Yeah. That's great. I am very excited for this. I want to see this, and I want to be able to sometime down the road have you on here talking about the release of this coming out.
And we would love that.
Excellent.
So that'd be great. So, moving on, you want to bullshit about some pop culture stuff?
Bring on the bullshit.
Now, there was a weird confluence that happened this weekend in that you are doing a film about the unreleased Fantastic Four movie. And this weekend, Arrested Development released 15 previously unseen episodes. And a major plot line was that one of the new characters played by Maria Bamford had played the Invisible Woman in the unreleased Fantastic Four movie, of which they showed footage from the Arrested Development version of their conception of the Fantastic Four film.
Yes.
I
wish I could take credit for this and
somehow
say that we did it.
But when I watched it this weekend, I was like, oh, this is hilarious.
Yes.
And there's many scenes of Tobias dressed as the Thing.
Yes.
So it's clearly out there in the
zeitgeist.
And
the name of the musical, they make a Fantastic Four musical.
Yes.
Yes.
Facebook is just full of it. It's pictures are everywhere.
This couldn't have been better timing for you.
It couldn't be better timing. We are obviously figuring out, because it's a high profile,
how to capitalize on it.
We're trying to figure out how to capitalize it. We have a couple fun ideas, but we have very little time, and we're already obviously in the middle of a fundraising campaign. But we've got a few ideas of how to tap in and
you got to
speculate.
Tweet at Mitch Hurwitz about this. Like, hey.
Make it happen.
Are you an Arrested Development fan? Are you a fan
of
the show?
I've seen them, yeah.
You did not do what we did, binge, because you've got important things to do. Me and Sean, who don't, we binged on all 15 episodes over, I probably did it over about 24 hours.
That sounds about right for me as well. It was a rough Saturday night. Let's just leave it at that.
It was, and here's my takeaway on the new Arrested Development. I love it. I actually really do love it. I know a lot of people are a little like, because it is different. Especially at the beginning, what they do is each episode focuses on a specific character, pretty much. So you don't have a lot of the interactions that you had in the first three seasons. But, and there's also, in those early episodes, there's a lot of exposition.
They're laying a lot of pipe.
But even by episode four, I fully was submerged in this new way to tell the story, and I thought it was told in a really brilliant way, in especially the last few episodes, seeing how everything comes together. I am all about this. I think it's as good as ever. And my favorite episode, and I'm surprised because I might have taken this character for granted, I think my favorite episode might be the Maybe episode late in the season, because it's an episode where things really come together.
The best way to approach these new episodes is to view it not as 15 separate episodes, but as one massive 9-hour episode that is structured the way that a traditional episode of Arrested Development would be structured. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I think as individual episodes of television, it fails a little bit, but as something different, it's absolutely groundbreaking. It's not perfect. It's sloppy. It's messy. Don't try to overthink some of the plot lines and
It'll come to you. You'll get the whole thing.
It's there, but it's not ultimately satisfying, but I enjoyed the hell out of it.
I think you're going to be more satisfied watching it a second time through. I think, because I actually do think it works even as episodes of television. It's just because we're binge-watching these things like 6 years later. I mean, it's been a long time.
The only one that looks younger, strangely enough, is Liza Minnelli. Everyone else has aged noticeably. The only other major complaint I had, if it is a major complaint, is that it makes you realize how zippy and how tight the 22-minute episodes were without any time constraints. I mean, there was no reason each episode couldn't be an hour. It's baggy. Each episode is a different length, and I think that works to its detriment. They over-rely on the narrator. Scenes just play out longer than they should, and I think if they were forced to jam it into a 22-minute box, it would have been much tighter.
Of course, now we need the movie. We need the Arrested Development
Getting
movie.
Selfish now.
Well, we do. We need it, the way this thing ends, so I'm assuming there'll be a Kickstarter for that.
Was there anything about this season that you think is an improvement?
I actually love the way that the story comes together. There are all these different plot lines that crisscross in a way that, and I think the series used to do this to an extent, but I think it does it to, like, a hyper level, which I really enjoy.
Like I said, it's like a one episode blown out to 9 hours.
And I think, actually, like I said, I might have never really appreciated the maybe character so much, but I think seeing a full episode focusing on a character made me appreciate that character
but also,
more.
Conversely, seeing a full episode on one other other characters makes you realize, maybe we don't need a full episode with George Sr.
So now the question to you is, and I apologize because this is a topic you haven't seen, so you can't comment too much, when are you going to get on this thing? When are you going to be watching these episodes?
This week.
Okay.
I mean, I would have watched it. It was Memorial Day weekend and crazy. But I love the show.
Yeah. Damn it, you should have watched them before coming on. Do your homework.
I'm saying that even without the Fantastic Four footage, this is a show that I've been waiting for. And
it's good. And just give it a couple episodes because of the single character focus, the first few episodes especially don't feel like normal Arrested Development episodes because you're just spending so much time with certain characters.
Well, moving on to things that none of us have seen, so we could probably all comment on them better. Will Smith's got a new movie coming out this weekend with his wiener kid called After Earth. Maybe I shouldn't call him wiener kid. I don't know. But the thing that's funny about this is he's doing, like, the family media tour. Like, him and his kid are everywhere. This is their summer vacation. They're going around trying to sell us on After Earth, an M. Night Shyamalan film.
By the way.
And I've been talking to a lot of people. I wanted to ask you about this because I've been talking to a lot of people who this is having an adverse effect on them. They see Will Smith on a talk show with his kid trying to sell this movie, and they're yelling, and I don't know if this is necessarily fair, but they're yelling like nepotism. They're yelling does anything about this process rub you the wrong way at all, or do you?
No more than the rest of the world. Hollywood gets a bad rap with nepotism because I think if you go into law firms and businesses and banks, nepotism is alive and well and kicking. And Hollywood, like with many things, just gets a beating because we're pretty and we make billions of dollars.
Specifically us.
We're easy.
Yes.
We're an easy target.
You're not going to have those lawyers on the cover of People magazine.
No.
So, yeah.
But those lawyers still need to, you know, go to law school. You don't just get a job
at
daddy's firm.
I'm making fun of Will Smith's kid a little bit because it does scream like I've bought a franchise. But Jaden Smith here, if he's a good actor, then he will have a career.
If he is not,
this will fall apart and this won't let. I mean, like Sofia Coppola, for example. I happen to like her films. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people could say, maybe she got her start because of her father. But she won an Oscar because she made a really good film.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Roman Coppola is shooting Samsung commercials.
Right.
So that says something. One Coppola better than the others.
Well, that's definitely true. But at the same time, I don't 100% agree with what you said about how if somebody isn't great, they're not going to have a career. I mean, I think this kid's going to have a career.
No matter what.
No matter what. He'll be a TV star. He'll star in bad movies.
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
At the very least, he will have a career because there's a lot of people careers who are awful.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But he won't have our respect, which he doesn't need.
I'm sure that's going to keep him up at
night. He doesn't have Will and Sean's respect.
At the red carpet premiere, he's going to be surly and mumbly because Will and Sean, disrespected him. You don't want to start beef with Jaden Smith, though. Just saying.
He's friends with Justin Bieber.
Yeah.
So, then you got Bieber on your ass. And
you're fucked.
Yeah.
That's not good.
They'll find you on Twitter, and that'll be the end of you.
We got to get – maybe you should get some attention for the Indiegogo. Like, go after Bieber or something. Get some, like
– we've considered various negative adverse campaigns.
Have you really?
Money. Well, not in any other context than this.
Michael Chiklis, we're coming for you.
Well, of course, the legal issues come up, and so we were like, well, let's try to be as offensive as possible because if you know, a big studio sues us to prevent – this from happening, it's the best thing that could happen to us. So if we could raise ire, we're all for it.
I've always said the same thing with any endeavor. I'm like, I have nothing. What are you going to take from me other than give me attention?
You're nobody.
Take all your DVDs
until somebody sued you.
But you know, here's the thing. I mean, I'm not going to see this After Earth because I personally don't think it looks very good.
How are you going to review it for the Minettis?
I'm not going to. The Minettis are off that week, so I don't have to review a movie, thankfully. But I'll go see some indie film or some foreign film that they don't know what it is. But, you know, I mean, if I was like some 13-year-old kid and my dad could have bought me a movie franchise, he probably would have, you know, if he had the money. I mean, right? I mean, you would have...
Well, I don't think Will Smith is the first person to do this either.
Yes.
But it's so high profile and it's so... I can't remember someone else at such a young age.
It's probably because he's starring with his son that brings so much added attention.
Tatum O'Neill.
Oh.
We all see how that turned out. But Tatum O'Neill, Paper Moon is a fantastic movie.
It is a fantastic movie.
Well, not $200.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not. I love Tatum O'Neill. I love Ryan O'Neill. I'm not saying it wreaked havoc on Hollywood. But I mean, she never would have probably even had that audition if she wasn't Ryan O'Neill's daughter. And while that's fine, you know, it brings these kids have advantages. And I talk to young actors all the time and I tell them, look, you know, they have advantages. So you have to have your ducks in a row. You have to train. You have to have your materials. You have to tweet. You have to do your PR. The cream will rise to the top.
Exactly.
The Edward Nortons will rise to the top. But if you looked at Hollywood, I think you'd also be surprised. There are a lot more cases of nepotism in various... Well, in certain forms. There's an advantage. George Clooney, Anne Hathaway. These are people who were connected to the business enough that it mattered.
Right? Yeah.
Not that they're not
Julia
talented.
And they're... Yeah, all those people...
Exactly.
All those people you named are I happen to think, very talented people.
Yes.
And it's...
For every Julia, there's an Eric.
Yeah, although he's done some good things. I feel like he's become... Well, he was in Sharktopus.
I really think Eric Roberts gets a bad rap.
I know.
I grew up on Eric Roberts, and I've worked with him, and I am just like... I wished he could get what Robert Downey Jr. got, that real renaissance.
Robert Downey Jr.'s example.
But I was going to say, Mickey Rourke in that speech talking about how Eric Roberts got a bad rap.
Yeah.
You know,
he did, and I think he'd probably admit he might have earned it, like a lot of these guys who are smart, or they come out and they say, I was a bad boy in the 80s. I just wish people would see him and take a chance with him, like a Quentin Tarantino would take him, because he's a great actor.
Take a chance on Eric Roberts, Sean.
Okay. Maybe he can narrate The Doomed.
I know.
That would be
That's
awesome.
Actually... Get Eric Roberts
on
board.
Don't joke, because I would love to get Eric Roberts on board.
Give money to Doom so he can get Eric Roberts on board.
Yeah.
I know, Sean, you listen to a lot of music.
I listen to some music. I wouldn't call myself a music man.
You listen to music? Who doesn't?
I occasionally have listened to music.
You're not a sociopath. You listen to these things. I don't.
I don't know if that's... mutually exclusive.
But I know, Sean, you wanted to briefly talk about this embarrassment of riches you feel right now.
Yeah, there's
in
a lot
music.
Of a lot of good albums at the beginning of the summer. We've had some good albums be released. The new Daft Punk album, which has been a phenomenon. Who knew that these alien Frenchmen with their helmets would?
Everybody is talking. You're on Twitter. You notice everyone is talking about this Daft Punk album. Do you notice this?
No. I might not be in that area of the Twitterverse.
I don't follow those people.
You're probably better off. I have noticed this. I haven't listened to any of it.
Well, it's you've heard it, and you just haven't realized you've heard it. I can promise you.
Okay.
These guys that brought electronic music to the mainstream, they're very enigmatic. They do these amazing stage shows. Their concert tour that they did in the mid-2000s still goes down as one of the greatest concert shows, and it completely changed the way that people conceive of how you can do with the lights and the stagecraft and the lasers and the upside-down glass pyramids and all this
upside
crazy...
Upside-down glass pyramids?
Yes. So
I see that in every show I go to now.
Ironically, the upside-down glass pyramids also opened for them. So you have Daft Punk, and you have The National, which is...
What is that?
The National is rich white people music.
I've never heard of it.
It's like if Leonard Cohen weren't tiptoeing on the edge of weirdness constantly.
But that's what's great about Leonard Cohen.
Right, but The National, it's indie rock. It's a dude with a growly baritone that sings wonderful songs about being an inadequate Caucasian male in America.
I say you and the rest of society listen to The National. Me and Mark will listen to Leonard Cohen.
And then the last album, which I really haven't stopped listening to, and I think this is actually a classic album, the new Vampire Weekend album.
Okay.
Is fantastic.
Here's my thing, and let me get your thought on this. And I haven't listened to any of these things. That's the only reason I'm poo-pooing a little bit. I apologize. Like on the way here driving, I heard like the Rolling Stones on the radio, and I'm singing along. I love the Rolling Stones.
Sure.
None of these. Like I mean, when I'm older, am I gonna be hearing Vampire Weekend? Do you think like these bands will last like those bands did?
Well, like those bands, a couple will.
Yeah, okay.
Always. I mean, I think a time period has to be represented because the 18-year-olds today.
That's their music.
There are a lot of them. They will keep some of them around like we keep the Rolling Stones around.
I really do believe, and I've said this in different contexts, I think every generation, every era has its artists that create a form of creative expression that is attuned and relevant for that time period. And so if you had had... If Mozart were alive today, he may be making electronic music.
He'd be Daft Punk.
He'd be Daft Punk. So I think, not that they're genius, I'm not equating them with Mozart, but I'm just saying that the talent will adapt itself to the expressive needs of that generation. So, you know, it's never that music was better than this music or this music is better than the old music. It's just different, and it always is.
Daft Punk did the score to Tron Legacy, right?
Yes.
That was a good score. That was the best thing about that movie. Then Olivia Wilde.
Very much so, yeah.
You know, Olivia Wilde, always the best thing about anything.
Even Magic Mike?
That's Olivia Munn.
Ah, God damn it. They should do, they're like the Corys. They got to do Munn, Wilde, and the two of them have to team up in a film.
The Olivias.
Can you cast this?
And you know who's still alive?
I will try.
Olivia de Havilland. She's like in her late 90s living
I
in...
I can't go there.
You can't bring Olivia de Havilland out of retirement.
I might go to the other.
She could be the matriarch of the Olivias.
Great trivia, because it's such a small town and such a small business. Olivia Munn, prior to being called Olivia Munn, was Lisa Munn. And the first film she did in Los Angeles was for me.
Oh, wow.
And it was called Scarecrow Gone Wild.
Did Joe Francis produce that?
They were actually afraid they might get sued, but he was too busy, I think.
Is this a film that's out there that we can...
Absolutely. It's Scarecrow Gone Wild. It was the third in the franchise of Scarecrow movies. And an old Corman buddy of mine directed it, Brian Katkin, and he said, I'm doing this movie called Scarecrow Gone Wild, and I said, I'm in.
I'm adding
the title.
I feel like that's almost every Corman movie. You just sell it on the title, and that's
and
everyone says
in.
I'm in.
Yeah,
that
like
kind
of puts,
that
you know,
kinda,
I'm in.
It kind of sticks. It's like that's Rock and Roll High School. It really is a good title.
I honestly need to get a copy of Scarecrow Gone Wild. And again, those same people who I'm telling to donate to this thing, that is right up their alley. Sean Corkery back on Long Island.
Madeline Kestner. Yeah.
Olivia has a very small part in it, but Ken Shamrock.
Is that a porn star?
Very big part. A UFC.
Oh, okay.
UFC legend.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
So, the other day, today actually, the day we're recording this, not the day this goes up, is my mother's birthday.
Happy birthday, Mrs.
Happy
Willink.
Birthday.
Wait, no, that's not right.
No, that's not quite right.
That would be if you were married to her.
So, you know, like a good son, I went to Rite Aid and I picked up some generic card with flowery words on it, and I wrote something nice in it and I sent it to her. And let me tell you what, I'm sick of this. I really, because a few weeks earlier, I had to do the same thing for Mother's Day. And you did too, Sean, right? You had to...
Well, listen, there's no, as I always said, there's nothing sadder than the greeting card aisle at a Walgreens at 10:30 in the morning on Mother's Day morning. It's just a bunch of sweaty, anxious, desperate men pawing through the scraps looking for some canned sentiment.
That was you?
I was there at 10:15.
Yeah, that was me.
Now, yeah, so you did the same thing.
That's what we do.
And I feel like my mom appreciated, but I know, like, a lot of, like, do you get a lot of birthday, like, my birthday, you get birthday cards, people send you a birthday
less and
card.
Less.
Less and less as the years go on.
I think it's time. I mean, you literally, you get, now, the thing that disgusts me is the Facebook birthday greeting.
Yeah.
People do that instead, and I'm like, really? You went that far out of your way?
Oh, when it reminded you that it's my birthday.
That's yeah. The worst part. But just the fact that there were close friends that you would normally get a birthday card from now have the Facebook option. Really,
well,
not good.
I don't like that as well, because that's zero effort. At least
exactly.
The card is effort. But here's the thing. It's messed up effort. Because I bought this card, and then later I bought myself a fine meal at Taco Bell. The Taco Bell meal cost less than the card.
Yes.
These greeting card companies... are a racket. Like you said, canned sentimentality. And they're overcharged. It's paper. It's parchment.
You're paying for the intellectual property.
The intellectual property of saying love. I should just be able to call my mother, which is more effort than both these things in a weird way.
Send her a Taco Bell.
I should be able to send a Taco Bell gram. My mother should rather me be feeding myself on delicious Taco Bell than spending my last cents in the garden. And here's the other problem with the greeting cards. People send me the cards. And then I have this moral dilemma of how long do I have to keep the card? Am I going to throw the card out? And I'll be honest with you, unless the card is particularly witty, and it rarely is, they go in the garbage almost immediately.
Yes.
Because guess what? One, as the old Seinfeld thing said, I don't own a mantle to put them on. And two, you're never coming to my place because you live on Long Island and I live here. So guess what I do? I take the nice Best Buy gift card you sent me and I throw the card away. And I don't like that Hallmark and all you fuckers are ripping off my friends and family, sending me cards. I've had enough of it. So fuck you, greeting cards. You're the enemy of the podcast. Go fuck yourself. This has to stop.
If only there was a way to condense that sentiment into an easy, pithy form.
Maybe Hallmark's got something.
Well,
for
see, you got to do what I do, and I've been disgusted about these cards for a while. So I will always buy the ironic card and then amend it so that it now becomes something memorable. So, for example, I'm a big fan of buying communion cards.
Yeah.
Or bereavement cards, and then cross, sorry about your loss, cross out, happy birthday, you know.
Right.
You're trying to make it something fun for you.
Something fun for me, religious cards are always good, sympathy cards, anything in Spanish. You can never go wrong, and they get it, and there's that moment of cognitive dissonance where there's like a sad dove on the front and a weeping Jesus, and then they open it up, and it's like, woo, happy birthday, here's money. And then they put it on the refrigerator.
How long do you keep a card when you do get a card?
I have cards that were given to me in 1985.
You're either a much better person than us, or you're a hoarder.
Can I explain?
Yes.
Inscription.
Oh.
All about the inscription. I've had people write things, like my dad gave me a card once that I would probably never throw out. And the card is, again, one of those big, frilly, horrible cards that your parents buy for you. The inscription was something that had never been said before and lengthy, and you'd never throw that out. But it's rare.
Yeah.
I don't have a box of these.
I've got
five.
You've got them cataloged and folded.
I've got five of those.
I've occasionally gotten something either that did say something sweet that I've tried to say, or sometimes you get the cards around Christmas that have like they're like photos, and occasionally I'll save them like, oh, my little cousin.
Scrapbook.
But you know, for the most part, they're ripping us off.
Well,
yes. Yeah.
What if there were a way that we can make a card that the inscription can be removed so you can get rid of the card but you can keep the sentiments? I don't know.
I
gotta think about this.
Can I offer you a solution?
Lay it on me.
Make your own card. I've done that on occasion. I mean,
that's like you take a piece of construction paper and fold it in four.
Well, I think these days that you could actually come up with something a little, you know, I mean, there's a Staples on every corner, and they've got all kinds of paper and things. And
that is very thoughtful to the point where I did not think of such a thing. Instead, I just buy my mom crappy cards. But yeah. No, that's a nice idea. Here's the issue I'm also having. I got a card today in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
Open it up. Fucking glitter.
Don't even get me started.
Out. All these cards with the glitter. Can we at least agree on one thing, greeting card? Come on. Stop with the fucking glitter. Because I opened up, I had it on my hands. Then I was washing my hands. I had glitter in my sink. My sink looked like it had gotten a lap dance. It was a mess.
It looked like they had an outtake for The Great Gatsby was shot in your sink.
Yeah.
I hate glitter. Is one of the things that drives me insane. I had a girlfriend of mine once. She gave me a card. We're in my new car. Open the envelope. Glitter bomb everywhere, and it took me every ounce of self-control I had to not kick her out of the car and scream and tear it up in her face.
Now imagine opening that same card, all the glitter, and as you open it, it plays Who Let the Dogs Out. It gets worse.
Yeah, there are a lot of these and you know what? The greeting card company, they're already thinking, how can we fuck with these people some more? How far will they go? And actually, if that is their scheme, then I have a little more respect for them. If they're trying to see how far we'll go and how much we'll spend on musical, glittery, pop-up cards.
So, Will, your birthday is in a few weeks.
I know.
Friends of Will Link. Get to your local pharmacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sympathy cards.
Sympathy cards.
Everything. I want you all to be mailing him daily cards.
And I'm going to have a whole... And now I'm going to feel extra guilty about getting rid of him because I just said I was going to get rid of him. I fucked myself with this one. Yeah, my birthday's coming up. Just give me a firm handshake and a glass of Jack Daniels.
I'm going to go to a surplus store and just get a bag of blank cards and just give you a sack.
Card a day.
Yeah.
Leading up to my birthday, starting to the first 15 days of cards. Before we go, I always like to end with a little weird story that I see. And I saw this great story about a theater critic named Kevin Williams, who a woman was playing with her cell phone during some performance.
How unusual.
And he had had enough. And he took the cell phone from her from her hands, and he threw it. And the woman, of course, freaked out. She couldn't find the cell phone, never found it. I guess someone else must have picked it up, or I don't know what happened to her. And either way, the critic proudly has said he threw it hard enough that it must have broke.
Sure.
She says she's going to press charges. I say no court in the land will convict this man.
I'm on that jury.
He is... I would actively try to get on that jury.
I would serve on that jury, sir, for a month.
This man is the hero of the podcast. Our official first hero of the podcast. This drives me insane.
He didn't throw it at her.
No.
He didn't hurt her.
No.
God bless him.
Yep.
I say if anyone's... And this is like a fantasy of mine. I just want to rip phones out of people's hands.
The gym.
Oh, yeah?
I almost on a daily basis, I have that fantasy of taking this lady's phone, this guy's phone, whoever it is, that they're talking really loudly on, texting, doing whatever, distracting, and just throw it against the wall.
I want to make a quick comment. The texting, and I know this is slightly off topic, but you know, my mother complains a lot. The kids are texting all the time. You're talking and they're texting. I work with some coworkers who are of an earlier generation, and they have no problem talking loudly on their cell phones in public spaces, having long-ass conversations that no one wants to hear, and I'm like, can't you just fucking text this person so we're not all subjected to it? Because at least when I'm texting, I'm still kind of engaging with what's going on.
But at the theater...
Theater's a whole separate issue.
The theater, it's an issue. I guess I'm talking more of audio disruption.
Well, right.
That's what I was thinking. I was, you know, Friday was the first day in a long time I had... nothing to do. I had no work to do. I had nothing to do. And I said, you know what? I'm going to relax. I went to go see a movie. I went to a coffee shop. I'm there reading a book, just trying to relax. And there's some guy sits down next to me, and he had a 20-minute conversation, one-sided, that I'm hearing. It's like, walk away. Just walk away.
What about the doctor I was seeing next to at Starbucks who was diagnosing what sounded like severe medical issues over the phone? He was looking at charts, and I'm like, are you fucking kidding? Very personal, asking awkward diagnostic questions about urine and congestive issues.
How's your stool?
It was just, and this guy had a thick, I mean, he was the stereotypical, like, Jewish doctor, and it was driving me insane. I'm like, it's Starbucks, it's not your fucking office.
Well, yeah. That's the same thing. It's a gym, it's Starbucks. Public, we complain about losing privacy, but we're sort of taking
we
the
brought
express
it upon
train,
ourselves.
Yeah. And running
and
privacy
that's why I think that
flag,
as yeah. bad and as slightly obnoxious as texting is,
yeah.
I find it far less intrusive and far less putting upon other people.
There's also a time and a place. Like, if yeah. you and me, Sean, are hanging out, yeah. and you start texting someone, then, I mean, like, it's just you and me, and I know you. But then, I mean, if you're doing it, like, I don't know, on a date, or if you're doing it at some
or
a business dinner or something like that.
But are you saying you'd be okay with him if you two were having lunch or dinner and he just started texting?
No, I wouldn't. Well,
but
no, I guess.
That is rude.
But you know me, I'll pull out my phone and I'll... I don't sit there while I'm talking to you. And
yeah, I guess I'm. You know what? You're right. Fuck you either way. Don't text around me.
But it's 2013's version of picking up the phone and talking on it when you're entertaining.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess we're all guilty because I've been sitting with.
If I were one-on-one with you, like at a meal, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah,
but
okay.
like if we're hanging out around the apartment and like we're just chatting and stuff.
Okay,
you know I have my phone out.
That's casual.
We are gonna. Okay, here's what we're gonna do here.
On the
news feed
of the social group.
We're going to. We're gonna sit down. We're gonna break up down the rules of this, and on a future episode, we're going to announce our Will Sean manifesto of when you can and can't text people.
I'm not signing off on this.
The movie theater is the biggest, or regular theater is the biggest no.
So I'm okay at a funeral then?
Funeral's fine. Okay. Who died?
Whatever.
Who died in this scenario?
Distant relative.
They'll send him a sympathy card.
I'm going to send him an Elmo card for his fifth birthday and say sorry about your loss.
But I mean, I sit
Elmo's
there. And the thing that I think these people in the movie theaters, and I'm sure you can get behind me in this, Mark, is that they don't even, like, they probably are thinking, oh, I'm texting, I'm not making noise. But the light.
That screen, the minute the screen comes up, it pulls me out. One of my best friends does this.
Oh.
And it really makes me not want to go see movies or sit away from him.
Yeah.
Because we're just hanging out. We're going to see some movie. And I'm in the movie. I'm watching the movie.
Yeah.
And he'll watch it, but 20 times during the film, he'll do something and the screen lights up and he's got
to
check something or he's doing...
God forbid he doesn't check Twitter during the hour mark in Iron Man 3, you know?
This has been crotchety old man talk on the Will Sean podcast.
Hey, we're right. And
kids
I'll tell you
today,
what,
let me tell you.
Yeah, these whippersnappers.
All our guests would agree with this. Mark.
Even Andrea Marchand?
Even Andrea Marchand.
Right.
Mark.
Sir.
Thank you so much for coming and telling us about the project and everything.
Thank you.
Before we go, plug everything one more time. Tell us where to find stuff.
Yeah. If you're looking for us on Facebook, it's Doomed. Pretty much Doomed will get you to us everywhere because there aren't a lot of other things called Doomed. We like that.
I think there's an S&M club called that.
www.doomedff.com is our website.
Okay.
The Indiegogo page, just search Doomed. If you go up on Facebook, Doomed, at DoomedFF on Twitter, and any one of those will take you to all of the others.
Look, this sounds like a great project, and I really am hoping you get it off the ground. I want to see this. And also, you have a personal Twitter, right? People can follow you on that?
Yeah, at castinguy.
Okay.
And www.marksykes.com for my latest info.
Excellent. And go there, too, and I'm sure there are all links to all this stuff.
Absolutely. Do not send you a bunch of headshots, right?
You mean more?
More, yes.
more than I already get. Yes.
Sean, do the thing where you plug your things.
You can follow me at Twitter, at TheSeanDavid. You can also find, buy, and hopefully read my book, Triumvirs, Triumvirs, Amazon, Amazon Kindle, and I will be reading a humorous essay on June 13 at Sheddy's at 8 p.m. on 3rd and Fairfax. So come on down and watch me make the people laugh. Hopefully.
Go to that show. You can follow me at The Real Will Link. You can also listen to me every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on the PM show with Larry Minetti at crntalk.com. I try to tell them about movies that they don't understand. It's a riot.
But they think about The Hangover 3.
Oh, yeah. If you go back and listen to the archives, you could hear my scathing review of The Hangover 3. It was pretty awful. Also, you can read articles of mine at U1 Can like the city in France. I've got a couple of movies I'm going to be reviewing in the next couple of weeks. I should have some articles up there, including Almodovar's new film. I'm going to a press screening of that this week, so a review of that should be up soon.
Very exciting.
And I'm hesitant to say it because it happens to be the same night as Sean's thing, but that June 13th. But my thing's a radio thing. You can listen to my thing actually at any time, I think. So don't listen to it at this point. But I will be a guest on Shriekfest Radio with Denise Gossett talking about this podcast and my experience with her festival and all, just tons of great shit. So, yeah.
So download that podcast after the fact.
Download that after, or listen to it that night at 7 and then go right in at 8 to see Sean perform.
No one's going to do that.
No one's going to do that. Next week on the show, we have the very funny Sharon Houston. She was supposed to come on a while back. She had to reschedule. Houston had a problem. She's coming on. She's a terrific comic. She also has a podcast called Daytime Justice. She's great, really funny, excited to have her. And the week after that, we have Nate Wagner and Alicia Camden. They host a podcast called Invitation to Love, where they give romantic advice. And, no, I said that like a question, but that is what they do. But it's kind of a fun show. They also interview people. But the theme is kind of love. And the interesting about them are their ex-boyfriend and girlfriend.
Oh, so that won't be awkward.
So I want to know how they make that work, and they're going to tell us.
Excellent. So sounds good.
Sounds good. Thank you once again, Mark. It's been great. And
for the Will Sean podcast, I'm Sean David.
I'm Will Link.
And we are finished.
We're finished.